Well, hello everyone, and welcome back to The Stagey Place. More precisely, episode 3 of series 3. And what a way we have started this series. With Rebecca Pitt in episode 1, our graphic designer, and Danny Can in episode 2, our theatre photographer, we have gained so many more followers and listeners over the past two episodes. And so, if you are new here, welcome to The Stagey Place. My name is Elliot Shepherd. I am a freelance stage manager, and here on The Stagey Place, we talk to those who work behind the scenes in theatre, and today is no exception as we are welcoming the amazing Amber Savard, who I've worked with in the past on Medusa, which we did at the Pleasance and at the Cockpit, and we also did a little project in between the lockdowns when we filmed Hold of Me, which was a play which I wrote, and we also did a live stream of it at the Etc. Theatre in London last year. So I think that's about everything covered for today's intro, but do stay tuned to the outro of this episode as I've got a very exciting announcement regarding next week's episodes. So do stay tuned for that. But for now, let's sit back, relax, and listen to the amazing theatre maker Amber Savard, who's in the hot seat for today's Stagey Place episode. Hello, Amber. Welcome to The Stagey Place.
Hello. How are you?
I'm very good, thank you. How are you?
I'm good. Excited to be here. Ooh, I feel very special. That I'm a guest.
You are a guest.
Guest on a podcast.
Yes, exactly. And I'm very excited to have you on today because, and it's weird because you're also a podcast host with Riffs and Scripts, which we'll talk about later on. But I find it so weird being a guest on a podcast rather than hosting a podcast because I just feel a lot more relaxed talking about myself rather than getting me to ask questions to other people. And I just feel a lot more relaxed. I don't know how you feel about being a guest. Is this one of your first times?
Oh, yes. I mean, it's hard to say, but yeah, it's definitely a bit more fun. I think that when I'm making my own podcast, I'm trying so hard to like do my job and create, whether it's production value or plan at least topics. I don't actually write a script for mine, but plan some kind of bullet points and make sure it flows and wonder how hard the, and there's so much I'm thinking about, whereas when I'm someone's guest I can actually just have a laugh and a chat and I don't know, it's just a bit more carefree for me.
Yeah, and I definitely, you know, as a host, like, you're kind of listening to a recording and you're thinking, oh, what's going to be taken out, what am I going to edit, how am I going to get this down to a reasonable size for listeners, you know. So I definitely think, you know, it's a lot more relaxing being a guest. But here we are, Amber, and I'd like to thank you so much for coming on to my podcast, The Stagey Place.
Thank you for having me.
Well, today, Amber, I'm sure you're wondering what we're going to be talking about. We're going to be talking about you as a theatre maker, and I call you a theatre maker because it's something that I like to say to all of my friends. I like to talk about all of the people who I've made friends with whilst freelancing, because a theatre maker is somebody who does everything. It's not just the acting, it's the producing, it's the directing, you know. It's amazing, isn't it? It's all over the place.
Not how it works anymore, is it? It's very rare and very impressive if someone can fully support themselves being solely an actor.
Absolutely.
That you have to have really got yourself great momentum that you're managing to keep up constantly. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Yeah, it just doesn't feel like it's very realistic anymore.
No.
At least for the first half of your career.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Because I feel like, you know, when we're talking about like contracted actors from like, you know, TV and film coming into theatre, they kind of are there just to do the acting, whereas, you know, coming out of drama school, you've got so many people who are creating companies. That's where you see the theatre makers, because it's all about the process of the work and the writing and the directing and the devising. You know, me and you, Amber, we first met devising doing Medusa at the Cockpit and the Pleasance. Well, it really is about doing the freelancing and the theatre making and being adaptable that makes us all theatre makers. So, Amber, we're going to start off today's episode by asking you your first question, which is, what was a younger Amber Savard like?
Amber Savard.
did you come into theatre quite early on in your life?
It started off as a Saturday class that I, in my memory, I took it because I wanted to do what my older brother was doing.
Yeah.
And he and some friends his own age joined some Saturday classes, and I wanted to be like him in that little sibling way. I don't remember this, but it's a story my parents have told me. I apparently wasn't a very tantrum heavy child.
Really?
I was emotional and I would cry and whatever, but I wasn't very tantrumy. Apparently when they took me to this drama school on a Saturday to pick up my brother, I sat on the floor and I screamed because I didn't want to leave. So little toddler Amber was like, this place is magic. I'm not going anywhere.
Yeah.
So I don't really remember, very clearly at least, a time of my life where my weekends weren't taken up by these classes. And I just loved it. So
yeah,
I was there right up until I went to uni. Every mm-hmm. Saturday forever. And it would be the children's group lessons that were like half an hour of singing, half an hour of dance, half an hour yeah. of drama. But then as I got older, I started taking ballet and I started taking breakdancing,
yes,
which
yeah.
you might not know about me. I used to do breakdancing.
Please tell me there's some videos out there somewhere.
Somewhere. I don't have any, but oh gosh. Yeah, and I just found more and more things that I love to do and yeah. was doing Lambda exams and then I did my GCSE there so that I could do an extra GCSE at school.
Yes.
So it just, yeah. it really did become such a big part of my life. And my parents were not pushy. Neither of my parents have ever worked in the arts. And yeah. every summer, like at the end of a school year, they'd be like, are you done? Like, you don't, this isn't forced on you. And I'd be like, hell no, I'm not done. And I think when I was like maybe 12 or 13, I found out there was such thing as a drama school.
Oh.
I was like, so there's a place that you can go to. And all yeah. day, every day will be like my Saturday.
The dream.
Sign me up.
Yeah.
So that's how it started.
And I know that you were saying there that you kind of did the weekend classes because like your brothers and you wanted to be like your brothers, you know. And I know that you said you weren't really a tantrum kid, but did you like having that spotlight on you with like the attention seeking and people talking about you for everything?
I mean, yeah, I'm not going to deny that. Absolutely.
No, yeah, yeah.
But this is the thing. If I try and really cast my mind back to the beginning, you know,
yes, yeah.
maybe the spotlight kind of happened because I was the drama kid. I remember actually applying for university and someone said to me, how do you think drama changed you as a person? And I was like, the thing is, I don't know if it changed me because I've been
yeah.
doing it so long. It molded
Absolutely.
Me. So
yeah.
I don't know if I love drama because I love the attention or if I love attention because I did drama and realized
yes.
how good it felt.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, it's hard to answer. It really is. But like I said, my earliest memories were just, I was a little kid who just wanted nothing more than my brother's attention.
Yes.
And I was the kid who would ask if I could sleep in his bed every night and ask, oh, I didn't want us to get too old to, you know, share baths or have a... I really, like, adored my big brother and just wanted to be his partner in crime so badly. So
yeah.
in my memory, that's what started it. He grew up and got over it and he's now a lawyer, but I just didn't. And I stayed there and it became my happy place. It became the day of the week I looked forward to the most. And there was a stage, genuinely... The dance lesson started at 9:30 in the morning and my final drama lesson finished at 6:00.
Oh,
I was
God.
Doing a full work day there.
The best weekend.
Every Saturday and I did not tire. I
yeah.
really didn't.
No, best weekend. And when you're saying that, you know, you left these weekend schools and then you were looking at actually drama schools, you knew that there was a place that you could do this every single day.
Mm.
Were you looking at the acting courses or was there other avenues that you were hoping to go down within the industry?
Oh, there definitely were other avenues because, you know, when you're young, that's an exciting thing, isn't it? You think about what do I want to do? So there were things. I love animals. There were stages where I wanted to be a vet. There were stages where I wanted to save the planet and specifically save the ocean and the dolphins. I was the little girl acting out movies in my bedroom. If I saw something in the real world that echoed something from a film that I loved, I would jump on it like it was a set and act things out, and it would annoy me that people didn't get what I was doing.
So basically you watched High School Musical, you saw the canteen, you saw the tables, and you thought, I know what, I'm gonna jump on
that table.
Yeah, jump on.
Yeah, absolutely. Me and friends at drama school used to sit and have our lunch in different accents and stuff. We were proper little performer nerds. The world's a stage, darling. Yeah, it's awesome.
So when you then came to the realization that you wanted to be a performer, what were your actual first steps in actually conquering the dream? Because listeners may not know this about you, but you actually started quite young with one of your first credits starring alongside the one and only Kelly Brook in Fishtales. So how did you actually get into child acting and what was that experience like at such a young age?
You know, ups and downs, obviously. There's so much I could talk about that. So it started off as panto. So the drama school I went to on that Saturday, it was its own venue. It wasn't like in a church hall. It was its own building that did classes throughout the week and then mainly on a Saturday. They had an agency for children attached to them. So that just became something that it became linked for me. I naturally did both. So that was good. It didn't feel like a big shift. So when I was really young, I would be in pantomimes through them. And I auditioned. I had big auditions, to be fair, over the years. I auditioned to be Cosette. Like, I can't tell you how many times I had to sing Castle on a Cloud for some kind of audition, or Chitty Bang Bang, or me and a girl whose mum owned the company, and she's only a few years younger than me. We are livid that Matilda didn't exist when we were kids, because we know we would have been really good casting.
Do you know what? If I was in Matilda, I'd been Bruce, because
you would have been such a good Bruce.
Yeah, so let me tell you, we did Charlie and Chocolate Factory in primary school, and this was about year 5 or year 6, and I was playing Augustus Gloop, and I had Dairy Milk all over my mouth, just like smothered all over. And obviously, you know, Augustus Gloop, he goes down the chocolate fountain, and then we had to sit at the back of the hall in the primary school, and my year 4 teacher, Mr. Jones, he was telling me off because I was licking all of the dairy milk off my face because I was off. I'd gone down the thing, so he kept telling me off, and I was like, oh well, I just want to eat the chocolate.
I actually have an opposite memory. I, again, through this agency, we were on an Easter special of Richard and Judy, it was actually. And they took a bunch of us little kids and they dressed us up like Easter bunnies and we ate loads of chocolate. And then they took photos and videos of us with chocolate all around our faces. Now, I've always had this weird thing. I don't like people touching my face. Ah. So my mum was there with melted chocolate in her hands trying to smear it on me. And I was like, I hate this. I don't like it. But yeah. Panto happened. West End auditions happened. I didn't get any of them, but this is something I really wanted to mention, actually. I think probably the best thing about me being a child actor is I think I learned so early a lesson that I think a lot of adult performers struggle to learn, which is dealing with the rejection.
Yes.
I was going to so many auditions and I would go, Mummy, did we hear back? Mummy, did I get that part? And my mum had to, you know, teach me, you know what, hon? Yeah. You'll know if you get it. And if you don't hear, you need to just let it go.
Uh-huh.
And children accept things a lot faster. So I just learned really young, that's how it goes and that's how it works. So even now as an adult, I'll put on Instagram that I had a self-tape. And a week or two later, someone will go, oh, how did that go? And I'm like, I don't know. I did my job. I did what I need to do. I showed what I can do. And then my job's finished. And if they want me, they'll call me.
Yeah.
And I'm very good at letting go of things, I think, compared to a lot of people my age. And I think that's because I was dealing with that rejection.
You've had it. Yeah.
From so young.
Yeah.
The film was awesome.
Oh, good. Yeah.
So it was such a good filming experience. It was pulled out of school, sent to Greece. We were filming on location in Greece. So how, you know, right? I got quite a luxurious version of it.
Oh, God.
Night shoots were not fun, where your day started at 7 p.m. and ended at 7 a.m. Those happened and they don't care that you're a kid. I learned a lot. I think I learned at that stage, maybe right up until drama school, I would argue that probably taught me more about acting and acting as a job than any number of weekend classes ever could. But obviously there's a downside to it. I came back to my school after being away for a couple of months filming and my whole world had changed and my friendships changed. And I had a best friend that I did drama and dance lessons with who suddenly didn't want to talk to me anymore. And now that I've grown up and look back, I know that was her dealing with jealousy. But for 13-year-old me, I was looking for, I'd been away, I was homesick. Yeah. I was messaging them from the hotel every night thinking I had these friends to come back to.
You want
to
see them.
And then I didn't. And it really hurt and it was hard. And it was really tough for a young version of myself.
Yeah.
So, you know, and it's a good thing and a bad thing. Learn those lessons young again.
Absolutely.
But it does have an impact and it will create a chain effect, because whenever you do something that's different to everyone else, it puts a target on you, doesn't it? It others in a way that can be quite painful.
It's horrible.
But then at the same time, I'm going to be really honest, I got paid. I didn't get paid ridiculous money, but I got paid a decent nest egg.
Yeah.
And my parents, again, really responsible parents, they put it in a separate account. They obviously didn't take a penny, but that does exist out there. There are parents that do that.
And
that money
awful.
Kind of helped me pay bills and food and travel while I was at drama school. That's when I used it to support myself when I was doing full-time study at a master's level. Like when you're at uni, you can get a part-time job. When you're at drama school, it's hard. It's hard. It takes up a lot of your time. So it's had so many influences on my life. And yeah, it is. It definitely was a big pivotal thing for me.
Hi, my name is Emily, and I'm the proud owner of Your Little Theatre. Your Little Theatre is your new place to find pre-loved theatre plays at affordable prices. But we don't just stop there. We also match you with some ace small businesses. Kick back and relax with our Blind Date with a Play, where you receive a mystery theatre play for only £5. Or treat yourself even more and get any of our mystery boxes, which all include at least one theatre play or musical theatre score, plus some trinkets from our ace partners of small businesses, who include Hello You Handmade Co., Little Box Studios, Lucky Pup, Baking Bice Boobs, Luna and the Elephant, Geek Chic Gifts, A Hella Load of Quirky, Tom Kofed, Totalist Graphics, The Harmony Hub, and Stagey Prints, plus so many more. Thank you so much, Stagey Place, for giving us this opportunity. And remember to use code Stagey Place for 10% off on our website, www.yourlittletheatre.com. Thank you so much. And enjoy the rest of the podcast.
And let's just talk about a little bit about jealousy then within the industry, because how do you think it feels like now at the moment? I mean, maybe not in the pandemic, but, you know, definitely people are fighting for jobs coming out of this over the next few months. Like within your friendship groups now, if you're getting roles, like, do you still have that jealousy, and how do you conquer jealousy when your friends are getting roles that maybe you've also
gone up for? That's a
really
good question, actually. So I consider jealousy quite an ugly thing, and I'm not saying that it's not normal to be jealous. I'm saying that the emotion sucks. And I think because I had such a like saddening experience as a direct result of jealousy, I've literally felt jealousy ruin a friendship. I personally am not the biggest fan. So when I, and it happens, of course it happens.
It happens
when I feel jealous. I think I shine a light on it. I put a big spotlight on this green monster and I go, I'm feeling jealous right now, but that's not anyone's problem but me. This isn't in acting, but there was a really good example of this when I was maybe 16, 17, and a guy I liked another girl, and then a guy that I started dating, apparently it was well known that he used to like that same girl, and then my guy best friend confided in me that he was crazy about that girl. And I remember thinking, oh my god, does this girl want to take everyone in my life that matters to me? But it was never her problem. And even at that young age, I remember saying to myself, I had that chat with myself. I was like, okay, this is what jealousy feels like. And this is your problem to deal with. This is not her issue. She's done nothing wrong.
Yeah.
It's up to me to handle that jealousy. And that example, I kept my distance for a while I felt painful, while something was emotionally hurting me. And then I got the hell over it. And then also I got to know that girl. She's lovely. She's brilliant. And we were friends for years. Like I still run into her in London from time to time. We didn't stay in touch forever. But guess what? I caught the bug and I was like, you know what? I see what everyone sees in her. She's great. So I think maturity is a big part of it. I think self-awareness is a big part of it. I think whenever people feel negative emotions, whether it's jealousy or anger or rejection or whatever it might be, we tend to throw it outwards and we blame others. I think just be aware that's how you're feeling. Acknowledge that's how you're feeling, and it's human, and find it's up to, it's your responsibility to deal with it. It's not someone else's to deal with. In an acting way, when I get jealous, it's not actually jealousy. It's more a left out feeling. Like I went and saw Little Women last year and I cried my eyes out in the cinema because I love that story. And the film was amazing and the cast was amazing. And I left going, I didn't feel jealous, but I felt like, I want to play. I want to join in. When's my turn? But I don't think it's quite the same as jealousy.
No.
When you work with friends, I've got to give real good credit to Eliza, who you know.
Oh, yes.
Because we first met doing another musical where she was my understudy. And that can be a recipe for jealousy if you think about it. And it can be a recipe for getting badly competitive, and we just didn't. We became two peas in a pod. We got cast for the same part because we clearly have very similar energy and performance styles, and we would rehearse together and run lines together, and we became a team.
You click.
And not once did I feel any resentment or bitterness. In fact, bless her cottons, I think she was almost too kind about it. We were at an event in Edinburgh and some compere hands her a mic and goes, oh, what part are you playing? And I would not have minded if she'd have just said the part. Just say the part you're playing. Yeah. She actually went, oh, I'm the understudy for this. And I remember thinking, bless you, because she clearly cared about not insulting me. But I was there going, I wouldn't have minded if she'd have just said the role.
No,
I wouldn't mind at all. So I think leave your ego at the door, and with maturity and experience you should over time just get better at dealing with it. Not everyone does, but
and actually I think we're in an industry that really, you know, supports understudies and really, you know, shines a light on them, you know, more or, you know, equally as the people who play the main parts, because, you know, it's chemistry and actually it's really a compliment to be an understudy with the main, you know, actor or actress or performer who is in that part, because they are complimenting you as an actor. And I think it's amazing, and I think this industry really does highlight how amazing understudies are, whether or not that's the Mischief Comedy or Queens at Six, you know, like that's a massive fan base there that absolutely loves seeing understudies. And I saw the understudy for Evan Hansen when I first saw it in London. I've only seen it once. It was Marcus Harmon, but he was absolutely phenomenal, and it was his first show as Evan, and it was, he was astoundingly good. Like it was incredible.
I couldn't agree more. Like I've had it more than once. I think when I saw Hamilton, it was an understudy. And I was really excited, because you're right, I got to see something that not many people get to see. And I love an underdog. And I'm like, that person's been working just as hard as anyone else to learn that part. And I took my dad to see Phantom one year. And the understudy, Christine, was on. And she was phenomenal. And I know that musical inside and out. And I could tell that she was singing notes in a chest voice that most people can't sing in a chest voice. And I've got a very strong chest voice. I've got a very strong belt, and I couldn't have done it. And I was wowed by this woman singing. And I went home and I looked her up, and she really wasn't, I can't remember her name, but she really wasn't that well known. She was just some drama girl from like Sweden that was so excited to be here as the understudy. And I felt, yeah, really privileged that I got to see her.
So let's jump many years later then, when you've got your degree for classic studies and theatre at Royal Holloway.
Yeah.
You then went in to train at Arts Ed in the MA acting, and am I right in thinking that this is where you became the producer assistant for a production at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival?
Yeah, so basically what was really exciting about doing an MA as opposed to a BA is, and I say this with love, but when you go into a BA, 90% of the students are 18, right? And you're all at the same stage in life, and you're going straight into drama school, maybe 19 or 20 if you did a foundation course or a gap year, but that's it, and that's fine. But doing an MA, there was a really interesting mix of people.
Yes, of course.
All different ages and levels of experience. And we had people that had worked in finance for decades and realised it wasn't making them happy. And people pursued, it was just a really beautiful group. And someone from my MA became a movement director. And you're right, actually, it really wasn't long after. So I had a friend who said, I am movement director on this play. And the woman had written it, was funding it, was like, you know, making the play happen, was working so hard that she needed some help just keeping on top of the admin side and all of these things, and said to my friend Jen, do you know anyone who's really organized and creative and reliable and can help me keep on top of this work? And she said, absolutely, here's my friend Amber. So someone from my MA put us in touch, and initially this woman said, I only really anticipate you maybe doing 10 hours from home, helping me keep on top of emails and some scheduling stuff. I said, absolutely no problem, I can do that for you. And she and I got on like an absolute house on fire, and basically she just kept giving me more to do. And before you know it, I was running the social media, I was handling the D&D, handling the R&D, I'm so sorry.
That's all right.
And the guest list and the audition schedule, and when there were random little bits of costume that they hadn't been able to find, I was out on scavenger hunts finding them, and I was just filling in all these gaps. And then I'm making the program and I'm finalizing it and taking it to print, and then Rosie says, oh, don't forget to include special thanks to these people, like the R&D was at RADA, for example, things like that. And it included Amber Savar, assistant producer. And I kind of looked around and I was like, did I just assistant produce a show without knowing it? So I had her holding my hand and telling me what to do. And there were certain things I hadn't done on that occasion. I hadn't made contracts, for example. But it was one of those things where I kind of went, oh, I can do this. And I can do it well, because she did not have to give me job after job after job. She chose to because she found me reliable and she liked the work I was doing. And so, yeah, it made me kind of go, I'm a producer. And then after the run of the show, I had people coming up to me going, what does it mean to be a producer? And I was like, well, I've recently found out that it means this. So it was very much learning on the job, but it was really refreshing to do something like that, because I think a lot of the times we all take courses and courses and courses to prove that we qualify to do a job. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but it was really fun to just hit the ground running and get involved. So that was September to November. And then that December for New Year, I saw an old friend who is a director, and he had only worked really in short films at this stage, and he'd been an art director on features and stuff, and he had written his first play, and he's telling me about it. Now he's telling me about it from his creative, he's written this, it's his baby way, which is beautiful. But I'm there having just produced a show going, so what kind of venues are you thinking? What kind of numbers are you thinking? Oh, so how are you planning on using festivals? And all of my logistics questions he didn't have an answer to, and he looked at me like and then I was like, do you need a producer? He was like, yeah, please. So now we're in January 2020 and we're meeting up and we're planning budgets and we're looking at venues and having all these conversations. We've agreed on a fee for me, and then lockdown hit, and this poor guy was doing everything out of his own pocket. So not only are we not able to book venues and all of that and actually commit to anything, the day jobs he was using to fund it also stopped. So we've had to put that on hold. I love the guy to pieces, and I do think he was very ambitious. So the most recent conversation about it we had was me saying, look, I don't think that it's feasible to go straight to doing a full length show. We won't be able to get that kind of time slot as a brand new company. You're not a company that's done theatre before. You're not a writer that the theatre world knows. How would you feel about if we just did the first half, or if you wrote a shortened version? And then I can take that and run with it. I can take that and put that in fringe festivals. I can get reviews for that, and I know how to produce that, and then we can grow from there. And yeah. He said he doesn't want to butcher what he's written, but he said we might start with a smaller project, you know, walk before we can run. But unfortunately that's on a bit of a hold at the moment until we know what's going on a bit better.
Yeah, and actually what you just mentioned there you mentioned it at the beginning of that question was the fact that you weren't necessarily going into drama school to do your MA in producing, but because we as theatre makers are so adaptable and so accessible to move into different roles, whether or not that's directing or producing, I know that we don't necessarily have the credentials, let's say, but we're able to have all these people around us. You know, the advice that I give to people is to keep your networks, because you have a lot of people who can just help you along the way. Like you say, you had that one friend that you had from your MA that allowed you to become that assistant producer because they believed in you and you were reliable and you were always going to be there. Mm. And that is such a fundamental thing for us to have as theatre makers. And that's why we're so adaptable to move into any role that we see fit.
Well, yeah, I totally agree. It's worth remembering that, you know, this woman didn't say to my friend, do you know anyone who's done a producing course? Because that doesn't matter as much. She said to my friend, do you know anyone who is reliable and organized and who you think I'll get along with? And my friend went, I know exactly the person. I think it is definitely worth remembering. The criteria isn't actually what you think it is.
No.
There skills can always be taught. Okay, I didn't know how to edit before this year, and I learned. Hallelujah. And I'm sure we'll come back to that later.
Yes.
Skills can always be taught. There are certain things that can't be taught. Being a professional, being a hard worker, your work ethic, your timekeeping. You know, there are people where you could yell at them every day of their life about timekeeping, and they will still show up. They drive nuts. Those are actually way more important in any job, in the arts, in any sector. You can be taught how to use a program or how to build something. You can't be taught how to be reliable, professional, and likable. And that is really where the golden nugget is, you know?
Yeah, and I think, you know, that really resonates with me at the moment, because I'm doing a production which was meant to be on in mid-April, so mid this month that the episode's going out. And it's been pushed back to July now, which is amazing, and it allows us, you know, to have that real audience, you know, feel to it, because we just wanted to give our actors who are involved in the company a chance to actually act in front of other people. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, more than just, you know, just having that live stream. I know that we did a production last year, and though you were involved in a production that I did, that I wrote, and that was live streamed. But at the time, we didn't really know what was going on. And I just wanted to give people a focus to come into a theatre and see some, you know, see some actual other people and do some work. But, you know, doing this show and getting the gig as stage manager happened because the director of this show coming up, Izzy Carney, who was in series one, episode six, she was the stage manager on The Seagull, which was my first production in London. And I was the lighting designer. And we just got to know each other really well and just kept connecting. And it was so amazing to kind of get back in touch with her. We've always been in touch, but to do another project with her is really exciting.
People want to work with people that they like.
Yes.
You know, people care about who they have to spend all this time with. When I was at uni, I directed a production of Faustus, and I literally asked my friend, who, don't get me wrong, she was a drama student, very intelligent girl, but I wanted it to be her, and I asked her to be my stage manager, and she literally went, what do I have to do? She didn't know what the job was, and I went, here's what you have to do, here's the list, you'll do this with me, this with me, this with me, you know, you'll be handling the budget, you'll be helping decide set, costume, props, light, or, you know, you'll be managing all the stuff that goes on the stage. But, and I told her what a DSM was. I was like, you'll get a DSM. And then she was like, yeah, okay, because I cared more about it being her than it being someone who might know more than she did, but who I didn't know or necessarily get along with. There's no harm.
Yes. No, there isn't. And actually, going back to that project that I was talking about that we were involved in last year, Hold of Me, I got Adrian Tang involved as the director, but I never knew him. And he just got in contact with me because I put this out on a Facebook group that we were both in and said, look, I'm not looking for credits. I don't care what you've done. I don't care if you've produced the biggest show in the world. Like, if you're a nice person, absolutely, please get involved and we'll just work together.
No one cares about your talent if you're not fun to work with. If you've not got basic respect and kindness, and, you know, we're not saying you have to entertain the whole room, do you know what I mean? But just be who you are as a person. Your integrity is by far the most important thing.
I'm just going to jump in here. Hi everyone, I'm Robin from High Top Design, and you're probably wondering who I am. Well, I'm a graphic designer with over 10 years experience in corporate communications. I've recently been working with Elliot on the new logo for the Stagey Place, and I'm the one responsible for the cartoon versions of his guests. But why am I interrupting the interview? I just wanted to let you guys know that as well as podcast artwork, I can help with lots of other things. Design projects, CVs, photo restorations, websites, magazines, posters, programs, anything like that, just give me a shout. Honestly, no job is too big or too small, and I will work with you to make sure the end result looks awesome. Don't need anything designed? No worries at all. I know you love theatre as you're listening to this podcast, so you'll probably like my range of musical theatre prints and badges. I also have a cute range of mushroom pride pins, or I can make you and your family and friends into cartoon versions like the guests of this show. You can find all this and much more on my website, hightop.design, or give me a like and a follow on Instagram and Facebook. I'm hightopdesign on those as well. Anyway, thanks guys. I will now let you get back to the show.
Okay, so Amber, as I mentioned at the top of this interview, you are one half of the podcasting duo that brings together Riffs and Scripts, which is a mix between theatre and music, and which you co-host with Cole Bryant. Now, as you know, I absolutely love this podcast. I've listened to so many of your episodes, probably all the ones today, and I'm always messaging you, telling you how I feel about it, how I, you know, connect with some of the stories that you're telling. And even though Cole works in music and I don't know music that well, I'm always listening and I'm always really appreciating that side of, you know, being the lead singer of a band, or as he's done, you know, looking at the merchandise of a band, and it's amazing. So I do recommend everybody already listening to this episode to go ahead, if you haven't already, and listen to Riffs and Scripts, because it's a brilliant podcast. And Amber, I thought you could tell us a little bit more about the concept and where it came from and how you managed to actually produce this over lockdown.
Well, this is the thing. I want to dispel the idea that it was because we were in lockdown. Actually, lockdown held us up massively. So Cole and I met on a film set. We got on really well, like, to the point where we could feel, in fact, it wasn't just whispers, people straight up thought we were going to get together. We were there for weeks and we were on set at like 4 a.m. Everyone's just so sleep deprived, hovering over a bowl of beans on toast. And he and I would still be laughing our absolute socks off. So our chemistry is a really rare find, I think. And we stayed in touch. He came to London and saw one of my shows. He was going to be in London for a gig that I was going to go see that then got cancelled. But anyway, Cole does the writing, well, co-writing, but is the manager of his own rock band that he's been handling for years, years and years and years. And we were talking one day, and one thing that we have in common is we both have quite ugly laughs. His laugh is really like, like that's what he sounds like. And I cackle like a fucking witch on Halloween. So one day we were on the phone and we were making each other laugh like we always do. And I off the cuff went, mate, we need to have some kind of podcast where like the whole thing is who can make the other one laugh more. And then I hung up the phone and my brain went, I think that's a really good idea. And I let the idea sink in. I didn't say it again out loud until I was sure I wanted it. Because, in fact, this is really worth saying, guys. Starting a company, starting anything with someone, it's a much bigger commitment than I think a lot of people realize. And I've seen it end friendships. I've seen it burn money. You need to trust someone before you go into any kind of partnership with them. So I really did give it some time and some thought. And then one day I was like, look, how would you feel if we actually did make a podcast together? Because there's so much that we have in common, but also so much that's different. We can compare working in theatre and film and working as a musician. And he loved the idea. Now, part of the genius as well was that because he was already a professional musician, he had all the bloody equipment. He had the mics, he had the editing software, he had the sound booth, he had all of it. And I was like, look, I have a car, I'll drive to you. He's in Oxfordshire. I'll drive to you, we'll record together, we'll make a series, it's going to be great. And we recorded one episode and then lockdown hit. What happened was we were then in lockdown, and then also to make matters worse, I had absolutely no work because my job before lockdown was freelance workshops with children. So I was genuinely sat on my hands most days, and he was working really hard because he got a job with the NHS during lockdown and was working very long hours and he was exhausted. And I remember thinking, oh my gosh, how am I going to make this happen? Because I don't want to stress him out. I don't want to be nagging him and pressuring him and being the reason he's getting even less rest amongst all of this. I just don't want to do that because I don't want this to become a chore. I want us to do well, but I don't want it to be something he doesn't enjoy. And I had to learn on the job. Like, there's an episode that is really, really echoey because I sat at my desk, which is right next to a wall and a window, and the episode sounds like I'm sat in a bathroom. It's so bad. So I had to learn a lot on the spot, but I got all these new skills. We worked out how to do it. Towards the end of the year, Cole's time management, he'd found his flow with how to handle it. And bless him, he was concerned that I wouldn't want to do it anymore because he'd been so unavailable. And I was like, no, I really do want to. I just don't want it to be too much for you. And we had a really good chat and we were like, no, we're in, let's do this. And we've been doing weekly episodes ever since. And, you know, practice makes perfect. We're much better at recording episodes that don't need as much editing. And he is so skilled and technical, I'm trying to cover everything else. So kind of doing the producer to his stage manager job. So I handle the hosting site, which, you know, you obviously gave me lots of tips with, and I handle the social media. And so between us, we've really found our flow. But lockdown forced us to really adapt our techniques.
And if people want to follow Riffs and Scripts Amber on social media, whereabouts can they find you?
So, Riffs and Scripts, thank you so much for asking, by the way. Riffs and Scripts is in all the usual places. It's on Spotify, it's on Apple. We're hosted by Podbean, so you can go directly to Podbean's website if you prefer. We are launching our social media, Riffs and Scripts Pod. So the name of the title followed by Pod. That is on Instagram. Please do give us a follow. Basically, the quick elevator pitch is, we compare my work in film and theatre with Cole's work with his band. So we find common topics like venues and festivals. We then do comparison episodes where I might talk about headshots and he might talk about guitars. But also we have a laugh, we swear like sailors, and we have a lot of fun while doing it. So if that's something that we really do want to be informative and fun at the same time.
Yeah.
So there you go.
Amazing. Well, Amber, thank you so much for joining me on this Stagey Place. But for avid listeners who listen to the podcast, they'll know that this is not the end, because I have one final question for you. And that is, Amber Savar, where is your Stagey Place? So I know that I gave you this question beforehand for you to mull over and think about, but it can be a place where you first saw your first piece of theatre, your favourite piece of theatre. It could be a place where you've worked in the past and you absolutely loved and had amazing memories. Or it can just be a place that you like to think and go to whenever you think about theatre. So Amber, the time has come. Let me know, whereabouts is your Stagey Place?
Oh, I had an answer, but even just before I said it, like three others popped into my head. So I would say my Stagey Place is Jackson's Lane Theatre in Highgate.
Amazing. Brilliant.
You may remember me saying earlier on that I started off in panto, and my first panto was at Jackson's Lane Theatre.
It was
a production of Dick Whittington, I believe, and I was one of the rats. And so Jackson's Lane was just that first actual venue I performed in. It's got, you know, really happy childhood memories attached to it, so I'm always happy to be back there. And then I guess if I was to go completely at the other end of the spectrum, I would say the Old Vic is a venue that I just love. And then also at the moment, I'm really enjoying the Vaults. I love going to the Vaults. I can't wait for the Vaults Festival to be back. I really want to produce a show at the Vaults. So yeah, if anyone's looking for a producer for a Vaults production, you let me know. I've done seminars on how to produce at the Vaults. But yeah, if I had to pick one, I would say Jackson's Lane Theatre. I love it there.
Yeah, and am I right in thinking that that was where we had our first set, I think, of rehearsals for the first time that we did Medusa?
We did, yeah.
Yes, I remember. I didn't go around the whole space. We were only in one rehearsal room. But from what I saw, it was a really nice community feel.
Yeah, it is a lovely space. The theatre itself isn't huge, but they have a real variety of productions there, because sometimes they have got really high quality stuff, maybe something that's on tour and hitting lots of different venues. They will hit Jackson's Lane. It's very recognised. And then at the other end of the spectrum, you've got the more community stuff. And I think the reason that we were able to rehearse there was because Nell, you may remember, has worked with them before, so she arranged the rehearsal space for us. Another wonderful contact that I kept, and she writes her own stuff as well. So
are amazing. Well, there we go. Jackson's Lane Theatre is Amber Savar's Stagey Place. Amber, I'd love to thank you so much for coming on today. Obviously, we've been friends, you know, since about 2019, I think it is now, that we first did Medusa. And like we say, we just got on so well when we first met each other. It's just been so lovely to do this with you again. And like I say, I'm always in contact with you, listening to Riffs and Scripts. Once again, you can follow that at Riffs and Scripts Pod on the social media, like Amber said earlier on. And Amber, people want to follow you as a creative. Whereabouts can they find you online?
Well, I am represented by Bazan Talent Agency, if you want to go there for any acting work. But if you just want to have a follow of my socials, my Instagram is just Amber Savar, nice and easy to find. Twitter is Miss Savar. Amongst that, you'll get to know me really well.
Amazing. Well, Amber, once again, thanks for coming on to the Stagey Place.
Thanks for having me, darling. Take care.
And there we go. That was episode 3 of series 3 of The Stagey Place with today's guest, Amber Savar. I'd like to thank Amber once again for coming into the Stagey Place studio. It was absolute great fun to get to speak with her again. She is absolutely doing wonderful things, and you should definitely be checking her out on her social media. Now, as I said at the beginning of the episode, I've got a very exciting announcement about next week, because not only will we be releasing our episode with Sinead Smith, who is a theatre dresser and has worked at Mary Poppins and The Phantom of the Opera, we will also have a second episode being released on Friday from the creative team from Musical the Musical. I chatted with them a couple of weeks ago back in Massachusetts, so it's absolutely fantastic that we can talk overseas. And they have some incredible news about their musical, the Musical. So do be sure to check out that next Friday, as well as episode 4 of series 3 with Sinead Smith next Wednesday. But until then, I've been Elliot Shepherd. You've been listening to Amber Savar, our theatre maker. And until next time, I hope you have a lovely week, and I look forward to hear from you soon.